for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner met again last night on fiscal cliff negotiations. There are reports the distance between the two sides is widening. Susan Rice withdrew her name for Secretary of State, and the Michigan governor signed a so-called right-to-work law. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, Ron Elving, Senior Washington Editor for NPR, and Karen Tumulty, National Political Reporter at The Washington Post. I hope you'll join us, 800-433-8850. Email your questions to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. This question of Susan Rice taking herself out of the running as Secretary of State, is there any connection between her withdrawal and fiscal cliff negotiations? Karen.
Well, I've found something really interesting in both the letter that she sent to the president and some of the stuff that she is saying in interviews, including with NBC last night, which is she very explicitly said that she thought that her nomination and the controversy surrounding it, that wasn't a nomination, even being considered for nomination, was distracting from the president's ability to get through. She named a bunch of domestic issues, immigration, debt reduction, and jobs. And I thought that was interesting because it was a very explicit acknowledgement on her part that this was going to make it harder for the president to get what he needs in his domestic agenda.
It's more atmospheric, really, than a direct connection. It's not as though anything in the fiscal cliff negotiations has anything directly to do with Susan Rice as a person or with the job she was being considered for. But the overall relationship between the president, Speaker of the House, Republicans in general, and the Senate. And the Senate is a separate institution. It of course, is Republicans and Democrats, but it's also a place and a thing unto itself where everybody is a little bit of a separate duke or a separate principality, if you will. And some of the egos up there had been strained by the president insisting on Susan Rice at a time when they think there are a lot of more important things and when they have a candidate of their own whom they prefer for the job.
And, you know, presidents only have a certain amount of political capital to use. President Obama could have gotten Susan Rice confirmed as Secretary of State, but he would have had to pay something for it. It would have cost him some of that political capital and taken it away from other fights like the fiscal cliff. You know, Republicans during the campaign and at other times portray President Obama as a left-winger, as a socialist, as an ideologue. This is one more example that he is at heart a pragmatist. He decided that this was not a fight that was going to be worth what it would cost when there are other things that he needs to do.
Of course, he was defending her.
Well, he defended her, and then we heard less from him. And they had this, I thought, a very odd scenario here where she wasn't nominated, but she was, in fact, auditioning for the nomination. That those five appearances she made on the Sunday TV shows that proved to be so controversial, that was an audition to be Secretary of State. When she went to the Hill and met with the senators who were critical of her, that was a chance for her to show that she could get through a confirmation fight in good shape. After those meetings, the situation was worse in the Senate, not better. And that's why I think at that point it was inevitable that this nomination was not going to go forward.
Here is a tweet. Does the outcome regarding Susan Rice make President Obama and Democrats more or less likely to compromise regarding fiscal cliff negotiations?
I don't believe that it makes a great deal of difference to their willingness to compromise on the fiscal cliff negotiations. I think it has more to do with creating a situation in Washington where a compromise would be generally possible, where there's a little less of the brackishness and being at loggerheads for the sake of being at loggerheads on every issue. If you can take one thing off the table that does not have to be further negotiated, that does not have to represent another battle in the war, you get a little closer to the moment where you can get some kind of a negotiated truce.
So now you've got John Kerry's name being mentioned again and again. Karen.
Yes, and by the way, had Susan Rice been nominated, we would have had this really awkward spectacle of Chairman Kerry having to chair the confirmation hearings of this woman who was getting a job that, you know, he has made no secret of the fact that he wants. At this point, the, you know, guidance that I think people are getting from the White House is that barring something very odd happening, John Kerry's going to be the guy.
And what does that mean for the votes in the Senate?
You know, there are a couple dominoes that fall because of this. If Senator Kerry is nominated Secretary of State, as I think we all expect, it would be a big surprise for him now not to get it. There'll be a special election in Massachusetts. We would expect Senator Scott Brown, who won the last special Senate election they had in Massachusetts but was defeated in November, would very likely run for that again. It's a very Democratic state, but he's a good candidate, and you'd see that as being at least one that he could possibly win. You know, impact on other cabinet choices too. The president is in effect replacing his entire national security team, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, head of the CIA. Each nomination affects the next. He's also going to be replacing his Treasury Secretary. There are two interesting things to note. If Kerry is nominated Secretary of State and Chuck Hagel, the former Republican senator from Nebraska, is nominated as Secretary of Defense, which we think is likely, that would mean Vietnam vets head of both departments. That's never happened before. And if he goes in that direction and nominates Jack Lew, his chief of staff, as Treasury Secretary, for the first time in 20 years, there will be four white men in the four big jobs in the cabinet. And that is a kind of irony given the coalition that elected President Obama.
That's right. Right at this particular moment, we have a House of Representatives coming in January where the majority of the Democrats in that House will be women and minorities. And that's a first. And that is reflective of the Democratic Party, and it's reflective of the majority that elected President Obama, who only got 39% among white people.
You mentioned Scott Brown as coming up in Boston, in Massachusetts. Who on the Democratic side might they put forward?
You know, I think there are a number of people who could, possibly Congressman Ed Markey, possibly the governor himself, Deval Patrick. There's a big difference between now and when Scott Brown won in January of 2010. The Democrats were asleep back then, and Scott Brown was able to surprise them. This time around, the entire Democratic machinery of the state is revved up because of Elizabeth Warren's victory. Labor, I was up there several times to cover that race. There is now a ground operation and a ground operation that knows how to run a race and has done it quite recently. So this idea that somehow Scott Brown, who at one point was the most popular politician in the state, could just sort of walk into that Senate seat, I think is not necessarily true.
We don't even know for certain that Scott Brown would run. He may have other interests at this point, and he may not want to take two losses in a row and be finished in politics. He may want to save his water and come back at some more ideal moment for him to get back in the Senate. And then the other possibility in terms of the thinking of the White House is that even if in a worst-case scenario, and I think Karen's right about Massachusetts right now, if in a worst-case scenario Scott Brown did come back to the Senate, he wouldn't be the least tractable. He would not be the person they were worried about, let's put it that way, in the Senate, because he is the sort of person who would need to be a centrist in order to get reelected. They could work with him.
Come back to Senator John Kerry. How good a Secretary of State might he be?
He seems he has the perfect credentials to be Secretary of
Why?
State because he has a long political history. He ran for president. He was a Democratic nominee for president and came close to winning. He has been on the Foreign Relations Committee for years and is now the chairman of it. He has been running for Secretary of State since Barack Obama was elected president. He has done secret missions on behalf of the administration. He has guarded the administration's interest on Capitol Hill. He has, I think, in no case caused any embarrassment or problems for the Obama White House. These are issues he's been dealing with. He's popular with fellow senators. Senators tend to like other senators. That's why senators have easy confirmation battles in these cases. So I think the thinking is he's got the stature and the personality and the background that would make him a very credible Secretary of State.
And this is an administration where most of the policy setting in international relations is done inside the White House. You know, even a secretary as, you know, of such stature as Hillary Clinton has not really been, you know, at setting the policy on the central issues of foreign policy. So, again, Susan Rice, there may be an opportunity here for her to be national security advisor, which in terms of just sheer decision-making power is a job that is, I think, on an equal with Secretary of State.
Not unequal. I mean, it's right. A great job. It's not unequal with being Secretary of State. The senior member of the cabinet. I mean, it's a different job. It's a consolation prize.
Would she have to be confirmed?
No, not for national security advisor. Then you're just working for the president.
So in the meantime, she stays at the UN. What kind of a job is she doing there, Ron?
I think she's doing the kind of job that we have come as a nation to expect of our ambassador to the United Nations, which is not necessarily super diplomatic. When you think about the period of time that John Bolton had the job, and there are some interesting parallels about the whole Bolton nomination process, confirmation, non-confirmation, recess appointment, ugliness. One of the people fighting against him at the time, of course, was a new senator named Barack Obama. But when you think about him as one extreme version, we like a United Nations a representative for the United States to go there, be tough, punch some noses. The other day, she reportedly said some tough things to the Chinese representative about their position on Korea's missile launch and how it hadn't been tough enough. And, you know, this is the kind of thing we like to hear, I think, as American consumers of news about the United Nations. It may not be the best way for us to get ahead or make new friends in the UN, but that's not what most people want. We want to be represented.
Ron Elving of NPR. When we come back, we'll talk about Michigan's right to work law. Take your calls. I look forward to speaking with you. First email from Diane in New York. The president's failure to stand by Ambassador Rice is eerily reminiscent of his abandonment of Elizabeth Warren when he refused to appoint her to the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, the very organization she had sponsored. Susan.
There is criticism of the president by some prominent women who support him, including women in his administration, that he didn't do enough to stand by her and respond, especially to the attacks on her account of the situation in Benghazi, for which there is a defense. And some liberal Democrats generally feel like he should have stood up. He has power from having won re-election and won more decisively than we might have expected, and that he should have fought harder for her.
He did fight for her for a period of time, for a period of weeks. We saw a combative president. We saw him personalize it. We got the strong impression, I think a lot of people in the media, that the president might not have been planning to appoint Susan Rice, Secretary of State. He might have had John Kerry in mind all along, but that, given the Benghazi controversy, given the attacks on Susan Rice, he had said, well, now we have to fight for Susan, and we're going to go ahead and we're going to nominate her. That impression was given out of some aspects of the White House. And so we had this prospect that the president was going to, as Susan said earlier, spend a lot of that political capital from this election, which, granted, he does have, on something that might be what we call a Pyrrhic victory. Even if he got her confirmed, which he probably would, he would pay a cost for it. It would hurt negotiations on many other things. And as Ambassador Rice herself said, it would make it more difficult to do immigration reform and a number of other things because of that expended capital being gone.
Will we ever know whether Susan Rice was deliberately given the wrong information to go on those talk shows with?
Well, people like Senator Lindsey Graham were saying yesterday after she withdrew herself from consideration that that investigation is going to continue.
So whether we know or not.
That is an excellent question, and it really goes to the heart of the whole controversy. Was she sent out as a sacrificial lamb with what people knew was not good information so that she could take the heat and she could protect the president's reelection prospects there? Remember, it was September, early September. It was a very close race. No one knew what was going to happen. The president was clearly running on the Osama bin Laden decapitation of al-Qaeda, and here suddenly was the prospect of a new al-Qaeda threat. A terrible story, a terrible tragedy in Libya, and it could have turned badly, badly for the president right then. And they were able to buy a little bit of time, get the intelligence cleaned up, get the whole thing back on keel so it didn't hurt the president so badly. And she bought them that time, and she may have bought them that time with a huge sacrifice on her part, possibly, although we'll never really know, possibly costing her the chance to be Secretary of State.
I continue to be perplexed by why there's so much focus on the talking points, though, and not more focus on the actual failures of security in Benghazi, which seems to me to be a more important issue and one that I think we're going to hear Secretary of State Hillary Clinton have to address when she goes to Capitol Hill next week.
All right, let's talk about Michigan's governor signing the right-to-work law. Had he not previously said or indicated he was not going to sign a right-to-work law, Ron?
He certainly left that impression with a lot of people who thought that he was not committed to signing it and was not necessarily all that happy about having the issue forced to his desk, not happy about having the legislature vote on it, not happy about having, you know, the chance to become the new Scott Walker of 2012.
So what happened?
Well, he says that Democrats actually forced the issue by pushing, indicating they were going to push for a constitutional amendment that would enshrine in the state constitution collective bargaining rights, and that therefore Republican legislators then wanted to respond by passing this law, this right-to-work law, in which he then signed. And they did it in a heartbeat. I mean, for a big piece of legislation, they did it like in the space of a week from saying they were going to do it to having the signing ceremony. The governor, who's known as a kind of pragmatic former businessman Republican, has tried to avoid some of these divisive issues in favor of what he thinks of as bigger, more important issues. His argument is this got forced on him and that this was the right thing to do for the state's economy.
Karen, what does this right-to-work law actually mean?
Well, what it does is it says that if you work for a company that is represented by a union and you share in the benefits that that union negotiates in its contracts, you do not have to join that union or necessarily pay the dues or even, you know, pay dues or pay anything. So you know, I think at this point, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's how many?
24.
24. Okay. So it's about half of the states in the country are right-to-work states. One thing that Governor Snyder argued is that that Michigan is facing competitive pressures from other states that are right-to-work states because they are seen as more open and friendly to business.
But, you know, for years, for decades, unions have represented the working people. And for years, the idea of unions fighting for those working people has been at the forefront. This sort of turns it on its head by calling it a right-to-work law.
And look at where this has happened. Two states have enacted right-to-work laws this year, Indiana and Michigan, in the heart of the industrial Midwest, Michigan, where the UAW was forged. And I think that made this defeat so much tougher on unions and labor leaders who have faced some significant setbacks in terms of union membership for a couple decades now in this country.
I have an email here from Jerry in Kalamazoo who says, I'm a business owner. I was a union member for only 6 years, 35 years ago. But for the first time in my very long life, I am ashamed of Michigan. You cannot imagine how painful it is to say so. Michigan was a proud foundation of worker rights.
That's right. A place where the union movement got its start. And the UAW argues that its representation of workers in the auto industry helped create a middle class in America.
Exactly.
Of people who didn't have a college education but worked hard in auto factories and were able to have to buy houses to send their kids to college.
But I do think that we've seen two instances where the state unions have sort of overreached politically. In Wisconsin, by trying to recall the governor, which I think Wisconsin voters, even if they didn't necessarily agree with the voter, with the governor on the issue, felt like, you know, this is not the kind of thing that you recall a governor over. And I think in Michigan that when organized labor tried and failed to pass this constitutional amendment, again, they overreaching politically, they exposed their vulnerability, and the Republicans were ready to come in.
So what happens to unions now, Ron?
To some degree, unions need to go back to making their case for unionism to the working people of the country. They have dwindled. Their political power has dwindled primarily because fewer and fewer people are in unions. And especially in the private sector, it's become quite a de minimis fraction of the total workforce, even though, of course, it's very important in certain industries. It has become increasingly seen by the rest of the country as some sort of special interest, not as their champion, but as some sort of special interest that is serving its own political and economic good, and that as an organization as opposed to somebody fighting in their interests. If you believe in unionism, you need to go out and make the case for it. You need to make people say, yeah, I understand that I'm making $10 or $20 or $30 an hour instead of a couple of bucks an hour because of this union that fought for this 20 years ago, 30, 50 years ago, and is still fighting for that higher wage today. If people are sold on that idea, they'll come back to union membership whether they're required to or not.
And it's not even just the wages. Union members, both public sector and private sector union members, enjoy a lot of benefits that that people who are not union members don't. And I think there is, you know, when you look at the fact
that job protection
and traditional pensions as opposed to 401ks and those sorts of things. And there is this disconnect between, you know, the majority of workers get and then what they see union members getting.
In Wisconsin, there was a big divide when they were recalling Scott Walker earlier this year between the private sector unions that sort of liked Scott Walker to a large degree and with whom he had made nice, and the public sector unions, the teachers, the government workers, who were very angry at him for taking away or restricting their collective bargaining rights. And so when he came down to the recall vote, you did not get an overwhelming vote among members of the UAW and members of other private sector unions in favor of recalling Scott Walker. So that divide within the union movement itself, that's what's really costing them power.
And it's also true that some unions remain pretty popular. The governor, the legislation in Michigan carves out exceptions for police officers and firefighters, and who had some of the same kind of protections in the battle in Wisconsin.
All right, let's talk about negotiations. I put that in quotation marks. On the fiscal cliff, President Obama and John Boehner met again last night. The two sides hanging tough to appease each of their bases before finally coming to an agreement, Susan.
So this is the issue. Are they hanging tough so that in the next 2 weeks they can make the case, well, we've hung tough long enough, let's make a compromise and have a deal? Or are they hanging tough in a way that means they will not make a compromise? Neither side will be willing to make the concessions first. And we will have a much messier situation, either going over the fiscal cliff, or Republicans, some Republicans on the Hill now talking about a sort of plan B that would involve letting the Bush tax cuts expire for the wealthiest taxpayers and leaving the fights over some of these other issues to next year.
To next year, specifically to approximately February, when we're going to hit the debt ceiling again. And, of course, it was the debt ceiling in August of 2011 that caused the last one of our great crises on all of these issues, and which caused the rating agencies, or at least Standard & Poor's, to downgrade the United States debt and cost the stock market a huge hit and set back the recovery and did a lot of other things that did not redound well for the president or for the Republican Party. And you would think they wouldn't want to go there again. But if the Republicans have a choice between fighting this out in December, when the issue has been framed pretty well by the Democrats and by the president and by Jack Lew, the chief of staff, who did all of this back when they negotiated the sequester, this fiscal cliff thing is coming down to a set of terms that are very favorable to the president. You see it in all the polls. People are with the president on this. He's well over 50%. The Republicans are under 40%. This is a situation where the Democrats could come out ahead. So as Susan has suggested, this plan B is let's kick the can just for 30, 60 days, get to the point where the real issue is no longer the sequester or the tax increase for 2% of the population, but rather the debt limit. And there the Republicans feel they have ultimately the threat of allowing us to default on our obligations.
And what happens on December 31st?
Well, a lot of people's taxes go up is what happens.
And the defense spending goes down.
Yeah, exactly.
And long-term unemployment benefits expire.
Exactly.
And the alternative minimum tax patch is gone.
Are both sides really prepared to do that?
I've been in Washington long enough that I'm so cynical. I cannot recall any negotiations of any magnitude that were settled or even began to look like they were being settled when you still had 2 weeks to go. These guys just don't work unless they're like college students. They can't work unless the exam is tomorrow.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So, does the big sticking point remain those taxes on upper income?
The big first sticking point are the tax rates on households that make $250,000 a year and more. And that's a fundamental one, and it seems as though we don't get down the road until we get past that one. But, boy, it's not going to be the last sticking point because there are going to be following that will be a debate over what we do exactly about entitlement spending. That is what Republicans want. If Republicans give on tax rates for high-income taxpayers, they're going to do that only if the White House and Democrats are willing to give on Medicare and Medicaid and possibly Social Security, maybe less likely Social Security. That is another titanic battle. So two weeks is both a very long time and a very short time to negotiate these things.
All right, so I want a prediction from each of you. Are we going to have a deal before midnight December 31? Karen?
Well, my predictions are worth exactly what you're paying for them. But I still think they're going to come up with something. It may be just a patch that gets them through to the next thing. But I just can't imagine for the wealthiest that everybody's going to see their taxes go up on January 1st.
Ron.
We will see some kind of a deal, but it may not be anywhere near as global as it needs to be, and it will be an extension of the negotiations into the political climate of the next 30 to 60 days, bringing the debt limit into the question. I think the president will prevail on some big, showy things, but he will not prevail across the board, and he'll be right back in the soup negotiating with these same people in January.
Susan.
I agree with both of my colleagues. I think there will be a deal. It will raise tax rates, perhaps not back all the way to the Clinton levels of 39.6%, and it will have some concession on the part of the White House toward Republican concerns on entitlements, but it won't be the grand bargain that they tried to negotiate in 2011, and these issues will be back early next year.
I want to be more optimistic. I'm going to say they come to a deal. Taxes do go up on that top 2%, and we have a grand bargain. You can, forget it, even though I've said it.
And Diane, every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings.
I love it, Karen. Now, let me ask you about this announcement from Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. Susan, he said he's going to tie the current low interest rates to...
He's going to tie it to employment levels. This is interesting. The Fed has never before tied these decisions to specific numbers in the economy. They're going to do so in this at this point.
To inflation.
And to inflation, but but a higher measure of inflation. Their target has been 2%.
Right.
They're going to let inflation get just a little bit more than that.
2.6.
And continue to, yes, in an effort to combat this very stubborn problem of unemployment. So this is a significant shift by the Fed, and it also indicates to investors that these very low interest rates are going to continue until 2015, say, because we expect unemployment to remain high enough for that to happen for two more years.
How surprising was the announcement?
Well, I think my colleague Neil Irwin at the Washington Post said the biggest surprise was that it was viewed as a surprise. There has been some need for a while to sort of calm the markets down and make this whole process a little bit more transparent. And this is what they were trying to do.
Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. By T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And by the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University, at cysimsfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. More than 100 nations now back Syrian rebels. Turmoil surrounds the Egyptian constitution vote. And North Korea launches a long-range rocket. The Week's Top International Stories. What happened and why? The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We'll open the phones now. Your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. First to Houston, Texas. Hi there, Andrew.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'd like to know, with respect to the budget deficit, why no one is talking about cutting the tremendous cost of the public sector. For example, why not put all public sector employees onto 401k plans so they can fund the cost of their own retirement rather than the rest of us having to do it?
Ron.
Actually, I believe Karen Tumulty made a reference earlier to how this is a big division in the labor a picture nationally where there are those that are the haves and the have-nots. Fewer and fewer people have a pension, but people in much of the public sector do have a true pension where they can retire at some point, sometimes with as little as 25 years or something along that line of service and draw a substantial amount of their last paycheck for the rest of their lives. That's a wonderful, wonderful benefit I think everyone would love to have. And it's the property, it's vouchsafed to fewer people in America all the time as 401ks have been brought in to replace it. And of course, 401ks haven't really fulfilled their promise either. They were supposed to make us all rich. And then, of course, they started going south after some of the downturns
all right.
in the markets.
To Carthage, North Carolina. Hi, William.
Hi, thank you. I would like to know why I'm not hearing the name of Richard Lugar as a possible nominee for Secretary of State. The political advantages of that are obviously enormous, and he's obviously qualified, so why not?
Karen.
I think if he were 15 or 20 years younger, you would definitely be hearing that. And by the way, he's not only qualified, he has worked very closely with President Obama in the past. When Senator Obama was in the Senate, his biggest foreign policy credential was the fact that he had worked with Senator Lugar on nuclear proliferation issues.
Yes, Senator Lugar actually reached out and took Barack Obama, the first-term senator, under his wing a little bit and liked him, and they worked together. And Lugar would probably make a magnificent Secretary of State in another era. But we're talking about somebody who's been in politics for 50 years and the kind
How
of travel.
How old is he?
Well, I'm just trying to fix the age. I would say approximately 80. I think we're coming up on 80. For someone at that age to take on the challenges of what a Secretary of State has to do in terms of travel alone, let alone the stress levels and so forth, I think Hillary Clinton and a lot of other people would line up and say, not possible.
Hillary Clinton has set her own record, has she not, in terms of miles traveled?
She's traveled an unbelievable amount. And you can see how exhausted, you can see how tired she
Absolutely.
Looks. And she says, you know, that she's not really engaging in the conversation of running for president because she really wants to get a good night's sleep first.
Here's an email from David, who says, I find it curious that Secretary Clinton has not been a forceful defender of Ambassador Rice. Is it because of her position, or is there something else going on? Ron?
She has the position, of course, to say, well, as the Secretary of State, I shouldn't really be commenting on my successor, and that's a perfectly reasonable answer. However, there is a little more history here than that. Susan Rice was in the Clinton administration. She had a position in the Clinton administration in the 1990s, and going into the 2008 presidential bid that she made, Hillary Clinton was rather counting on Susan Rice to be among her supporters. Susan Rice bailed out and went with Barack Obama. That is not the kind of thing that is forgotten by the Clintons. That is not the kind of thing that is forgotten by people who run for president. And there is that chance that on several occasions they may have crossed swords. There may have been moments when they didn't necessarily see eye to eye. And it would not really be proper for Hillary Clinton to get terribly involved in this particular discussion. But of course, if she had done so on Susan Rice's behalf, it would have been seen by a lot of people as quite a generous gesture.
Now, Secretary Clinton did make comments defending Susan Rice a couple days ago. But some people thought it was a little late. It was at the point where it seemed pretty clear Susan Rice was not going to be nominated.
All right, let's go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, Antonio.
How you doing, Diane?
Good, thanks.
I've been a long-time listener and first-time caller.
I'm so glad to hear from you.
I'm a college student, just got out of a class, labor relations and human resource management, so I'm getting a little bit of both sides of the corporate and the union side. Arkansas, we have a right-to-work state here. I'm against it, and the reason is why, because it takes away the voice of the people. Companies have the right to hire and fire at will without really giving an explanation or a reason why. So that lessens the power of the worker. My number two point I want to make is we will probably go over the cliff. It may be a benefit towards Obama and his administration, because if we go over the cliff, the American people will blame the Republican Party. Obama can then come back with a solution to fix it, raise taxes on the wealthy, lower taxes for the middle class and still come out on top.
That's why I think there's going to be a big deal. Go ahead, Karen.
Well, Antonia, though, gets to something that I've been wondering, which is why the Republicans would think their hand is going to be any better if they wait and fight this out again over the debt ceiling. They've got public opinion running against them so heavily now. What would possibly change that?
Well, but except the strongest issue that the president has is raising the tax rates on the wealthy. That's one of the specific things he campaigned on. We know 60% in the exit polls from the campaign, 60% of voters said they supported that idea. So that does seem to me that he has the strongest issue and the best leverage he has. Some of these other issues, obviously, he also has a strong hand. When you talk about curbing Medicare spending, for instance, that's not a popular thing. But I could see Republicans thinking if we get this issue of taxing the rich out of the way, it takes away the Democrats' best issue and maybe levels the playing field.
One thought, though, about the Republicans, what they fear most is not necessarily Barack Obama or even general public opinion. It's primaries. They're worried about 2014 primaries. Senators, members of the House, no matter how safe their district. In fact, the safer the Republican district, the greater the chance of a Republican primary challenge if they deviate from the line. There was a letter this week written by Morton Blackwell, for those who remember Morton, former head of the Virginia Republican Party, and signed by about 100 people who are a perfect luminary list of the Republican activists of the last 30, 40 years, some of whom we were surprised to see were even still around. And they all said, stand your ground, give nothing, absolutely no compromise with this president. House and Senate Republicans, if you give any ground, we're coming after you.
So this becomes a part of the debate that we're going to see unfold about what direction does the Republican Party go in the wake of their defeat in the presidential election 2012. And there's more than one school of thought within the GOP, one that they just weren't conservative enough. They need to be more aggressive. The other is that they really need to figure out a way to do more to appeal to women and to Hispanics and to young people.
And to Indianapolis. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Thank you. I so appreciate your graceful maintenance of this space for public discourse.
Thank you.
And mainly, I'm just frustrated. I feel like the Republicans keep interjecting terms into our major public discourses, terms that the media just picks up and uses, and it completely sends them skews the discussions. Terms like right to work, which is really just union busting, terms like entitlements, which everybody pays in this money, so they're entitled to that money back. And then there's other terms like job creators that set corporate heads up as deities, and then we all know the death panel discussion. So I'm a little frustrated the way media so easily picks up the terms that are planted by the right into these conversations.
Ron, do you want to comment?
Well, let's include fiscal cliff. Let's include lots of other things. Right to life.
Pro-choice.
Pro-choice. any number of political communications are dominated by whomever comes up with the best terminology to describe their position in a phrase or to frame the issues in a phrase that catches. And yes, we in the media are susceptible of that. We are truly susceptible of that because we're always trying to signpost things and we're trying to help people understand what the issues are. And if something comes along that catches the popular imagination, like some of these phrases, right to work is probably the classic example of all time of an issue that was totally framed by just coming up with those three words.
And skewed.
And, of course, it's framed by the people who favor those laws and don't want labor unions.
Here's an email from Brian in Flushing, Michigan. He says, right to work has nothing to do with labor or business per se. It's all about destroying funding for the Democratic Party. Of the top 10 donors to political groups, 9 donate to the GOP, 1, the unions donate mostly to Democrats. It's a statement, and it is indicative of why this union destruction is partly going on. And I do want to let our listeners know Monday We'll be doing a program in the first hour on what's ahead for unions. Let's go to Laura, who's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm an unemployed teacher here in Michigan, and I've been trying to figure out if this right-to-work move could lead school districts to be able to better fire teachers who really aren't pulling their weight and get some better, more passionate teachers in.
I think it's hard for us to see down that road, but I think it is likely to weaken the hands of unions, and all kinds of unions on all kinds of negotiations. I think it's hard to figure out exactly what it's going to mean to a particular thing like the question you raise. And by the way, Laura, good luck finding a job as a teacher.
Thank you.
To Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi there, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Well, I just had a quick comment. You know, I'm a nurse's aide in Framingham, Massachusetts. I live on my own. My rent is pretty high. I live paycheck to paycheck. I'm not the most educated, most political person in the world, but I know one thing, that if my taxes go up and my paycheck goes down, for lack of a better word, I'm screwed. It would be like a fiscal plummet, not a fiscal cliff. And if there's anyone in the Beltway listening, if I could sway you anyway, it would just be hardship on so many people I know. And that's not even a good enough word, hardship. It would be an absolute, I don't even know a good word. It would be horrifying.
So have you written to your own members of Congress? Have you called their offices? Are you urging them to negotiate?
Well, of course. But, you know, I live in Massachusetts. We just got Elizabeth Warren elected to the Senate. We have John Kerry in there. You know, we're the most liberal state in the entire country. I mean, my mother still has the bumper sticker from the Nixon era that says, "Don't blame me, I'm from Massachusetts." So there's not much I can do on that front.
Well, Kathy, I wish you the best of luck. I thank you for the work you do as a nurse's aide. Boy, do we need those jobs out there. And let's hope, as I have predicted, something good comes out of all this. Thanks for calling. And let's go to Fairfax, Virginia. Hi there, James.
Hi, Diane. I love your show. I listen every Friday at 10 o'clock for sure.
I'm glad.
My question was, if we went over the debt, I mean, if we went over the fiscal cliff, would that additional revenue have any effect on delaying hitting the debt ceiling and delaying that negotiation?
Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Ron.
I gather that just so far, just all the talk about the fiscal cliff and so forth seems to have slowed down just a little bit the growth of the deficit. It's not going to make enough of a difference. We're going to hit the debt limit. There's no way around it. We're going to be hitting the debt limit very soon. In fact, technically, I think we hit it very soon after the 1st of January, but the Treasury Department can move some things around, as they say, to keep us from actually defaulting on our obligations until February or March. But it's not going to take us into the summer.
How likely is it that the president will get the authority to lift the ceiling on his own?
I think the chances are very, very slim. I think that would be a huge battle for him to try to assert more executive authority on that. So I don't think that's going to happen.
But one thing that the president is asking for is that it be lifted as part of this negotiation and not have essentially this second bite of the apple for the Republicans.
All right. And finally, to Oklahoma City, Karen. Hi there.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been wondering what the difference is between what's considered a right-to-work state and an at-will state, because when I've moved to Texas and now I live in Oklahoma, I've had to sign papers that say they can fire you for any purpose. There doesn't have to be a reason. You can be terminated. And I've always equated right-to-work with at-will state. And to me, that's kind of a loss of rights of the workers.
But the at-will employee is free to leave at any time and be dismissed at any time. It works both ways.
That's an interesting distinction, and one that labor lawyers would probably have some detailed statement about, and that they might very well disagree about. But I couldn't tell the caller what the exact distinction is in her particular case.
Yeah.
Although a right-to-work state, again, is that has to do with your whether you're required to pay union dues if you are represented by a union shop.
Right.
And the union dues are the great focus of the campaign money issue.
So do you believe that other states are going to join in this effort?
You know, there's some advocates who say they're going to press it in other states, but I think the chances are not very good. In the states like Ohio, the Republican governor there, John Kasich, has said he's not interested in pursuing this. It's an issue that would take too much time, take too much effort. There are other things he wants to do. In a state like New Hampshire, where there are also advocates pushing for it, they've just elected a Democratic governor who says that she would not sign it. She would veto a right-to-work law, as the last Democratic governor did. So I think the prospects are not great that we're going to see this happen in a lot of other states. But this is not, again, an issue going away. We'll be talking about it in the future.
Susan Page of USA Today, Ron Elving of NPR, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post. Have a great weekend.
You too, Diane.
You too, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinker, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Urev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and